Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Statute of Limitations and Scienter Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 27, 2010, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Merck v. Reynolds. The case involves a securities fraud action brought under 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, claiming that Merck knowingly misrepresented the heart attack risks associated with Vioxx. The question in the case is what kind of evidence an investor plaintiff must have of scienter in order for the 2-year statute of limitations, which bars actions brought after the discovery of the facts constituting the violation, to start running. The applicable statute of limitations, 28 U.S.C. 1658B, also bars actions brought 5 years after the violation. In an opinion delivered by Justice Breyer, the court held that the 2-year statute of limitations starts to run, 1, when the plaintiff did in fact discover, or 2, when a reasonably diligent plaintiff would have discovered the facts constituting the violation, whichever comes first. The court also held that the facts constituting the violation include the fact of scienter, which is a mental state that embraces the intent to deceive, manipulate, or defraud. Finally, the court ruled that the plaintiff's state of knowledge during the period in contention did not satisfy this standard, and therefore the action could proceed. To discuss the case, we have Deckert LLP partner Stephen A. Engel. Mr. Engel was the counsel of record on a brief submitted by the Washington Legal Foundation in support of the petitioners. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Engel.
This is Stephen Engel, partner at Deckert LLP in Washington, D.C. I'm going to discuss Merck v. Reynolds, an opinion of the Supreme Court issued on April 27, 2010. In connection with this case, we represented the Washington Legal Foundation, which filed an amicus brief in support of Merck. In the Merck case, the Supreme Court considered how to interpret the statute of limitations for securities fraud cases brought by private plaintiffs under Section 10B of the 1934 Securities and Exchange Act. That statute of limitations, which is codified at 28 U.S.C. 1658, provides that a plaintiff must commence a securities fraud lawsuit within the earlier of 2 years after the discovery of the facts constituting a violation, or 5 years after the violation occurred. In an opinion authored by Justice Breyer, the Supreme Court held that the, quote, discovery of, quote, the facts constituting the violation encompasses not only when a plaintiff actually discovers those facts, but also when a reasonably diligent plaintiff would have discovered them, whichever happens first, and that the scienter element of a Section 10B claim is one of the facts constituting the violation that must be discovered for the statute to begin running. In so doing, the court resolved several questions that had divided the courts of appeals in the nearly 20 years since the Supreme Court had last interpreted the limitations period for securities fraud cases in a case called Lampf versus Gilbertson. In Lampf, the court first adopted the 2-tier limitation structure for the implied cause of action under Section 10B of the 34 Act. Congress ratified this 2-tiered structure in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, but extended the respective limitations periods to 2 years after the discovery of the facts and 5 years after the violation itself. In the 20 years since Lampf, the courts of appeals have reached general agreement over several principles in applying the statute of limitations. For instance, all of the circuits had recognized that the statute of limitations begins to run not just from actual discovery, but from the constructive discovery of the facts, that is, the point at which the investor, in the exercise of reasonable diligence, should have discovered those facts. In addition, the circuits had agreed that the investor's obligation to exercise reasonable diligence incorporates the common law doctrine of inquiry notice, which requires an investor, upon perceiving sufficient facts to raise suspicion of fraud, to conduct further investigation into the underlying claims. In its traditional form, the doctrine of inquiry notice means that when the information available to the potential plaintiff is sufficient to put the plaintiff on notice of a potential violation, what courts have called the storm warnings of a fraud, the the plaintiff then is charged with a duty to actually go and investigate the potential violation. And it's held to know, as of the time of inquiry notice, all the facts that could reasonably have been learned from a diligent investigation. Some lower courts treated this point of inquiry notice as the trigger for the running of the 2-year statute of limitations. Other courts held that the limitations period would not begin to run until a later hypothetical point, when the reasonably diligent plaintiff would have, having commenced the investigation, discovered the facts establishing the violation. In applying these principles to the securities fraud statute, the courts of appeals had disagreed over two issues. Does a plaintiff require specific information about all of the elements of a claim, and particularly the element of scienter, before being charged with knowledge of a violation? And two, does the statute of limitations run from this point of inquiry notice, or from some undefined point thereafter, when the plaintiff has investigated his suspicions of fraud and collected sufficient information to file the suit? Following the Third Circuit's decision in Merck, the Supreme Court granted certiorari to resolve these disagreements. In Merck, the plaintiffs had alleged that the pharmaceutical company had misled investors about the safety of Merck's product, Vioxx. Merck's public statements concerning Vioxx, however, did not go unchallenged. To the contrary, there was considerable public debate over Vioxx's safety. Most notably, in September 2001, the FDA issued a warning letter expressing its belief that Merck's interpretation of those studies was in fact misleading and directing Merck to make certain corrective disclosures. Notwithstanding these events, the securities fraud plaintiffs did not bring their suit until more than 2 years later, on November 6, 2003, after Merck, having reported disappointing earnings and its stock had experienced a sharp drop. The plaintiffs alleged that the revelation of Merck's false statements about Vioxx had caused a stock drop, and that they did not, quote, discover any potential securities violation prior to that time. Merck, however, pointed to the 2001 FDA letter and the public discussion on the subject as evidence that plaintiffs should have been aware of these facts for more than 2 years before they brought their suit, and therefore the suit should be barred by the statute of limitations. The Federal District Court in New Jersey agreed and granted Merck's motion to dismiss. On appeal, however, the Third Circuit disagreed and reversed the lower court's decision. After granting certiorari, the Supreme Court affirmed the Third Circuit. In applying the discovery rule and principles of inquiry notice, the lower courts had frequently quoted from the policy arguments that common law courts had articulated in applying the discovery rule and in formulating inquiry notice. The parties, too, in briefing the case, offered those same arguments. In its decision, however, the court gave little weight to these policy arguments about inquiry notice, equitable principles, and perverse incentives. Instead, the court did what it so often does in contemporary decisions addressing questions of statutory interpretation. It decided the case based primarily on a close reading of the language of the statute. Writing for six members of the court, Justice Breyer first read the word discovery, as did the parties, to incorporate the concept of constructive discovery, imputing to the plaintiff awareness of all information that would be available to a reasonably diligent investor. The court concluded that the word discovery is often used as a term of art in connection with the discovery rule. Courts had long interpreted the rule that way in similar statutes of limitations, Justice Breyer reasoned, and Congress is assumed to adopt the accepted judicial interpretations given to a specialized term when codifying it into a statute. The court noted that every lower court since Lampf had held that the statute encompassed constructive discovery as well as actual discovery, and Congress, in codifying the statute of limitations in 2002 in the Sarbanes-Oxley, did nothing to upset that prevailing interpretation. Accordingly, Justice Breyer found that discovery includes, quote, not only those facts the plaintiffs actually knew, but also those facts a reasonably diligent plaintiff would have known. Although all nine justices agreed in Merck that the statute of limitations had not begun to run, two members of the court, Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, disagreed with the majority opinion on constructive discovery. Those justices contrasted the statute at issue with the 1-year statute of limitations applicable to claims under Section 11 and 12 of the Securities Act of 1933, which expressly runs not only from discovery of an untrue statement, but also from when, quote, such discovery should have been made by the exercise of reasonable diligence. Accordingly, Justices Scalia and Thomas would have read the 2-year period here to begin only upon the plaintiff's actual discovery of the violation. The ninth member of the court, Justice Stevens, believed that the court did not need to decide the issue of constructive versus actual discovery in this case, and so he would have reserved the question. After defining the scope of discovery under the statute, the court next held, this time unanimously, that scienter is one of the facts constituting the violation. The court reasoned that a plaintiff who lacks evidence of scienter has no cause of action under Section 10b, and indeed, as the court emphasized in another recent decision, the Telabs case, Congress had imposed heightened pleading standards precisely to ensure that securities fraud plaintiffs do not bring their suits without developing and properly alleging a strong inference of scienter. Accordingly, the court concluded that scienter was assuredly a fact that, quote, is an important and necessary element of a 10b violation, and to hold otherwise would frustrate the very purpose of the discovery rule, because so long as a defendant concealed for 2 years that he made a misstatement with an intent to deceive, the limitations period would expire before the plaintiff had actually discovered the fraud. Merck contended that facts that establish a material omission or misrepresentation usually are probative of scienter, but the court disagreed, emphasizing that the mere falsity of a statement does not necessarily mean that the speaker knew the statement was false when he made it. Although Merck expressed concern that such a holding would cause plaintiffs to file stale claims, the court took the position that the statute of limitations also contains a 5-year absolute time bar on securities fraud actions, and so this statute of repose would eliminate any concern about undue delay. Finally, the court rejected the concept of inquiry notice as a potential trigger for the limitations period under the statute of limitations. According to the court, there's a difference between the point of inquiry notice and the point of discovery, and discovery is the word used by the statute. In the court's view, just because a plaintiff may realize that it should investigate its claim does not mean that it has necessarily discovered the facts constituting the violation. To the contrary, unless a plaintiff has made, or a reasonably diligent plaintiff would have made, such a discovery, the statute of limitations does not begin to run. And this is true whether or not the actual plaintiff undertook a reasonably diligent investigation. As the court stated, emphasizing the words of the statute, nothing in the text suggests that the limitations period can sometimes begin before discovery can take place. Although rejecting inquiry notice is a trigger for the statute of limitations, the court nevertheless recognized that such a concept may be informative insofar as it may identify a time when the facts would have prompted a reasonably diligent plaintiff to begin investigating. The point of inquiry notice thus could be relevant to determining when a reasonably diligent plaintiff would have discovered the facts. Ultimately, though, the statute of limitations may begin to run only when that reasonably diligent plaintiff would have reached the point of discovery. The Merck decision resolves the disagreements among the circuits over the appropriate interpretation of 28 U.S.C. 1658b. The decision does narrow, in some measure, defendant's ability to invoke the statute of limitations defense, particularly in cases where the plaintiff's suit was triggered more by the company's stock drop than by anything that the company said or did not say. On the other hand, as the court itself noted, its ruling does not affect the 5-year statute of repose, which continues to provide back-end security to potential securities fraud defendants. Although at first glance, the Merck decision might appear to depart from recent Supreme Court decisions interpreting strictly plaintiff's requirements for securities fraud claims, the court's decision actually reflects the court's solicitude for such heightened pleading standards. In demanding that plaintiffs file complaints only when they can allege facts constituting a strong inference of scienter, as well as the other elements of the securities fraud claims, the court is recognizing that the statute of limitations cannot begin to run before the point at which the plaintiff could have discovered those facts, reflecting all of those elements. In that sense, while the decision may narrow one defense to a securities fraud action, it does not disturb defendant's ability to move for judgment on meritless securities fraud claims, either on a motion to dismiss or at the summary judgment stage.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.